Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is Ethan Katz, author of The Burdens of Brotherhood, Jews and Muslims from North Africa to France, which was a recent winner of the National Jewish Book Award. Listen as Katz concludes the book.
As this book has sought to show, hostility cannot be considered the norm in the long history of Jewish-Muslim encounters in France. Nor have Jewish-Muslim relations in France necessarily mimicked the divisions of national and international conflicts. There have been three main strands to this argument. First, contrary to popular conceptions, for roughly a century, Jews and Muslims in France have interacted not solely or even primarily as members of their respective religious or ethnic groups, but according to myriad other categories. Second, the meaning of Jewish or Muslim ethno-religious identities in France has been highly situational, and only at specific historical moments, most often in the post-colonial period, became perceived as definitional. Third, from their very inception, Jewish-Muslim relations in France have not been solely about Jews and Muslims' relations to each other. Rather, they have constituted what I call a triangular affair, with France as the third party. That is, the French state and empire and notions of what it means to be French have always been crucial to Jewish-Muslim relations in France.
Tracing the past 100 years of interaction between Jews and Muslims in France, today the largest populations of these groups living side by side outside of Israel, this book could not be more timely, given the terror attacks in France this past year, first at Charlie Hebdo and Hypercaché in January, and then the ISIS attacks in November. With me to discuss this history is Ethan Katz. Welcome, Ethan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Ethan, before we wade into the past, let's discuss the present. Since autumn 2000, with the beginning of the Second Intifada, there have been nearly 600 anti-Semitic incidents in France each year, perpetrated mostly by Muslim youth. At the same time, Muslims are the next most targeted group in official statistics, and Islamophobic discourse is widespread in France. Today, an oft-told tale has taken hold about inherent conflict between these groups, conjoined to a narrative about civilizational conflict between Muslims and the West. What are the key factors since 2000 that are driving Muslim-Jewish dynamics in France today?
Well, I think you have a set of domestic and international developments that in some ways have just built upon each other in extremely volatile ways. So domestically, you have persistent socioeconomic divides between Jews and Muslims that have continued, in some ways even grown. You have the emergence of a kind of militant secularism that has cast religious difference, particularly Muslim difference, in the public sphere as being very problematic for being officially, quote, French. And this has been conjoined with a discourse from the far right about the crisis of immigration, as it's come to be understood, which is generally a translation for a crisis of Arab immigrants or Muslim immigrants. Meanwhile, you have had the persistence and intensification of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And this has led to the growing importance of Israel and Palestine for Jews and Muslims, respectively, in the way that they publicly identify in France, which already sort of sets the stage for tension. And, of course, you have the rise of global jihad, which has also had an important impact among a small minority of Muslims in France.
You're saying that Jews and Muslims in France really are in very different classes, very different socioeconomic conditions. You mentioned militant secularism. Can you just tell us a little bit more about the tradition of what in French they call laïcité, a secularism in France, and how that impacts this dynamic?
Laïcité, sort of the best translation we have is public secularism, comes out of the separation of church and state in France that's officially encoded into law in 1905. And this is both a set of laws around keeping your religion out of public spaces, particularly public schools, for example, and about not having officially supported religious institutions by the state, but it's also an ethos about being, quote, French first in public. Now, one of the things I argue in the book is that this was actually in many ways more flexible, at least in certain moments under the empire. And what we've seen really beginning with the first so-called headscarf affair in 1989, where you had three Muslim schoolgirls who were banished from a public school for wearing the hijab. Since that first great national debate that grew out of that, we've had this growing idea that what it means to be secular in French must involve really sort of total privatization of your religious identity, whereas during certain previous periods, there was more flexibility, more ability to be sort of French plus, if you will, in public.
You're taking us back in the course of this work 100 years. What is it that you wanted to show about the nature of Muslim-Jewish interactions over the past century? Why is that long-term perspective so important?
Well, I think it's important because, first of all, it gets us out of thinking about what we know today as what's always existed. We come to see that Jews and Muslims can't be understood simply to interact as Jews and Muslims, if you will. That is, we tend to think today that every encounter between Jews and Muslims in France is, quote, a Jewish-Muslim relation, that they understand each other principally or solely as members of potentially opposing ethno-religious groups. But if we go back to a moment where that was not the assumption, which is certainly the case during World War I and the period coming out of World War I, we see how a whole series of ways of identifying really defined a great multiplicity of encounters between Jews and Muslims, and then we're able to try to examine what dynamics produced conflict and coexistence in precise historical moments, just as there are precise factors today that have produced a moment of crisis.
So you're saying in a way that these identities have become much more rigid, and in the course of the book, you even say they become racialized so that they become essentialized and the only identities through which groups come to think of each other, and that that historically has not been the case. Now, why do you think it's important that the story you tell begins with World War I?
So there are several reasons for this. Practically speaking, it's the first moment where large numbers of Muslims come to the French mainland. So it's the first moment where you have widespread interactions between Jews and Muslims. Jews had been there in significant numbers for decades. More importantly, really, the state really positions itself then as sort of the third player in relations in a way that's going to have a very enduring impact and character. That is, the triangular nature of this relationship really emerges in the First World War. And globally, many of the factors that are going to be important for Jews and Muslims because of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the emergence of the mandate system in the Middle East, the beginnings of the rise of ideologies like Zionism and Arab nationalism, those forces also come out of World War I. So it's a moment where many defining elements that we come to see unfold across the 20th century are just emerging.
So if you start with World War I, I think your book really begins to show all of the nuances and complexities of the relations you trace between Jews and Muslims in France, beginning with your chapter on the interwar years. We don't have time to discuss all of these details, but there are several events that you discuss in the 1930s that were tipping points. Tell us about that moment and why it marked a turning point in French-Muslim-Jewish relations.
So in the 1930s, we can sort of think of these relations along multiple lines. Politically, there are a set of crises where you have touchstone events that are really quite significant as turning points that I think you're alluding to. One of these is the rise of fascism across Europe, the rise of certain fascist and extreme right groups in France, and the counter-mobilization of the left. This really begins with the riots in February of 1934, where a group of right-wing demonstrators are seen to have come very close to toppling French democracy. Whether or not they did is still debated among historians, but the perception of that both galvanizes the far right, who feels very empowered, and galvanizes a left-wing response. And Jews and Muslims as marginal groups are really in the crosshairs then of definitions on the part of both sides, really, in this debate about what it means to be French. And ultimately, many Jews and Muslims will become very invested in the so-called Popular Front, the left-wing anti-fascist coalition that comes out of this moment. And so there will be a moment of political unity around the Popular Front. Meanwhile, you have a crisis in Algeria that's also emerging, where it's becoming more and more clear that France has to figure out what it's going to do with Algeria, which many listeners may not know was not only a French colonial possession, but actually part of France itself, making the relationship of the state to its inhabitants much more complicated. And the touchstone event there is a set of riots in Constantine, Algeria, in August of 1934, where 25 Jews and 3 Muslims are left dead. And the sense of crisis is acute not only for Jewish-Muslim relations, but for Algerian colonial settlers and the administration, who fear that the next attack might be against France itself. And so this crisis is tied up with the question of fascism, And one of the reasons that they come together around the Popular Front is because there's a moment where it looks like there might be major reform in Algeria. And for Jews and Muslims, that reform is seen also as a path to guaranteeing more peaceful coexistence.
And I guess reform in Algeria had different consequences for these groups. Perhaps you want to tell us a little bit about the rights of Jews in Algeria already as French citizens and the way that was different for Muslims.
The Jews of Algeria had nearly all received full French citizenship in 1870 with an act known as the Crémieux Decree. Muslims, by contrast, were nothing like equal French citizens. They were in a category called indigènes, which translates to natives. They had a whole series of special restrictions, actually, that were only attached to them, many of them very arbitrary and brutal, really. And so in the 1930s, you have this proposal, which is actually comes out of the administration of Léon Blum, who was both the leader of the Popular Front government that came to power briefly and a proud French Jew. And he is one of the people who proposes what is frankly a modest reform bill that would have empowered about 20 to 25,000 Muslims in Algeria to become full French citizens. But that bill really does galvanize for a time a significant number of Muslims in Algeria who think it could be the beginning of their way to really become fully French.
Now, Ethan, your chapter on Jews and Muslims under the German occupation is a little bit different than the other chapters because you focus a bit more on Muslim responses to the Nazi occupation than on the Jewish experience. I imagine this is because you're reacting to the fact that there is much less known about that part of the history that you're writing, and also because what has been written concentrates a lot on how the Nazis influenced the development of Arab and Islamic anti-Semitism. If I'm getting that right, what would you say are some of the surprises your research has uncovered about the period of the Second World War and how it impacts the larger story you tell?
I would say that the sort of larger dynamic in a way was that I wanted to restore agency to Muslims during the Second World War as well. On the one hand, there is a lot that's been written, particularly in recent years, about Muslims as having been, you know, deeply shaped by Nazi propaganda during the war. But there's also another strand of literature that sees Muslims largely as passive fellow victims to Jews, even if not victims of the same order. I was able to access kind of an extraordinary group of documents that enabled me to peel back and see that Muslims are acting in a whole variety of ways. So the first surprise for many people is Muslims were not persecuted racially in anything like the same way as Jews during World War II. In fact, in many ways, they were empowered. They were really courted by a lot of parties, particularly pro-fascist parties, particularly the authoritarian state in France, the Vichy state, that is a pro-German government set up during the Second World War, and by the Germans themselves. And this gave them the opportunity, like other French inhabitants, to make fundamentally important choices about, you know, how they would affiliate politically and how they would treat their Jewish neighbors and acquaintances. And the range of choices that Muslims made is as wide as the range of choices that others made. So you have Muslims joining pro-fascist groups. It's hard to calculate the numbers, at least several hundred. You also have Muslims carrying out very heroic acts of resistance. And you have many Muslims trying to, you know, muddle their way through. But the other piece that's very important is that the considerations for Muslims were often very different from that of other inhabitants of France. And so even Muslims who decided, for instance, to support a group like the Parti Populaire Française, one of the most successful fascist parties in France during the war, they were not necessarily motivated by anti-Semitism. They were often hoping that things would be better under German rule, that they would have more autonomy, that they would be able to essentially overcome all the frustrations that they had had under the French administration for many years. They also were often anti-communist, like a lot of these groups, because of the extreme secularism of communism. So there were a lot of other factors at play. Anti-Semitism certainly was there, but part of what I was able to uncover was the complex motivations behind Muslim choices.
Maybe you can give us an example. You've written about what happened around the Grand Mosque in Paris. Tell us a little bit about that story and how it played out during the Second World War and illustrates what you're arguing about Muslims during the Second World War.
The Grand Mosque of Paris, which was the sort of first major Muslim institution in France during the war, there's been sort of a story that has circulated for a long time about the mosque saving Jews. I was able to do a lot of primary research into this. And what I discovered was that the head of the mosque, a man named Sihadot ben Gabrit, was a very complex actor. He really illustrates well the shades of gray, if you will, at the heart of many Muslims' experiences during the war, that they can't be divided into collaboration on one side or resistance on the other. He did clearly save a certain small number of Jews, tended to be people who he knew personally, but he also was in communication regularly with the commissioner for Jewish affairs of the French state, which was its own arm of anti-Semitic persecution. And they often asked him to identify whether or not someone claiming to be Muslim, there were a number of North African Jews in France who identified, claimed to be Muslim during the war to escape persecution, like Ashkenazi Jews who claimed to be Christian. And he would be asked, is this person actually a Muslim or not? In all the cases that I found, he appears to have said, no, 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 this person is not a Muslim. And so he clearly was, in those cases, collaborating. So this is an example of someone who was, in many ways, he was looking out, first of all, for its institution and its community. And in the process, he could both commit acts of heroic bravery on behalf of Jews, and he could also participate in their persecution.
I mean, the story that you're telling about Jews hiding as Muslims and in that way enabling them to survive the war is really amazing. And the title of that chapter is Jews as Muslims and Muslims as Jews, indicating some of the way in which the hierarchical relationship between them flipped under the Nazi occupation. Obviously, this is a very complicated story. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm talking to Ethan Katz about his National Jewish Book Award winner, The Burdens of Brotherhood, Jews and Muslims from North Africa to France. Now, in the post-war period, two factors seem really important to Muslim-Jewish relations. First, the Arab-Israeli conflict, and second, the Algerian War of Independence from 1954 to 1962, which was among the most violent decolonization struggles. You have two chapters on that conflict and its impact. One that discusses how things were in flux from 1954 to 1960, and a second in which you talk about the final phase of the war from 1960 to 1962, which you say was a, and I'm quoting you here, a hinge point that rendered the binary visions of the French-Algerian relationship all too real. Can you explain to us why the French-Algerian War was a hinge point for Jews and Muslims in France?
That quotation reflected the fact that in the first 6 years of the war, the first chapter where I focus on the war, chapter four, there's a whole multiplicity of ways that Jews and Muslims are responding to a struggle whose terms are very stark. Algerian independence on the one hand, Algeria being part of some greater France on the other side. But by the end of the war, by the closing period of the war that I cover in chapter five, people are having to make choices that increasingly pit Muslims as in favor of independence, siding with Algeria, and Jews as siding with France. And one of the things that really comes out of this, that really clinches this as a decisive moment, is the policies that France adapts as the war is ending. France spends the first 6 years of the war really trying, not only militarily, but also legally, to make Algeria even more French. And this involves giving Muslims in Algeria finally full French citizenship, encoded into law with the 1958 Constitution of the Fifth Republic. But by the closing period of the war, when it's clear that Algeria is going to become independent, France begins to rethink whether or not these people can be fully French. And at the very same moment, Algerian Jews are very concerned about whether they will be able to maintain their French citizenship, as it's becoming clearer to them that Algeria will become independent, that they may not be comfortable staying in an independent Algeria. And so they lobby very successfully to have their French citizenship guaranteed, to be able to come to France with the same rights as all of the European settlers in Algeria. Meanwhile, by 1962-63, nearly all of the Muslims in Algeria who had gained full French citizenship have essentially lost that citizenship. And so the rights and guarantees of the two groups as they came to France, because many Muslims continued to come to France from Algeria as the war was ending and in the years following the war, their rights, in contrast to the Jews, who came from Algeria, and almost all of the Algerian Jews eventually come to France, the contrast is stark, and that affects many things like neighborhood patterns, income, various kinds of opportunity, rights to welfare benefits from the state, and so forth.
And the other thing that you talk about is, of course, that there's an institutionalized Jewish community with organizations that are there in place in order to be able to help Jews who are emigrating, and that that did not exist for Muslims, and that that moment then very much sets the stage for that socioeconomic divide and the very different experience of integration into France that you talked about when we began. Now, Ethan, what impact does the State of Israel have on Jewish-Muslim relations in France, especially the fallout from the Six-Day War in June 1967?
The 1967 war is, I think, a crucial turning point. In the very short term, the impact is not necessarily felt that deeply, but long term, it's huge. With the war, French Jews begin to mobilize visibly on behalf of Israel in the public sphere in a way that is unprecedented, and that is, in many respects, at odds with the ethos of laïcité, French secularism, that we spoke about earlier in the program. And beginning really in May of 1968 with the student uprisings, student and worker uprisings that become connected to a number of internationalist movements, you have a pro-Palestinian movement moving into France through groups like Maoists and Trotskyites and other far-left groups, and they begin to mobilize Muslim workers also in visible ways, meaning that you have a much greater public identification with both sides of the conflict. You also have a shift in French foreign policy that comes about during and following the Six-Day War of 1967, where France moves from being maybe Israel's most important ally in the world to being far more critical of Israel and really trying to build relationships with the Arab world. And what that means is that whereas France's Israel policy had been pretty set in the decades before, it becomes a field of competition politically for the two groups in an important manner. And finally, the Six-Day War is a period where there is an intense wave of anti-Arab racism in France, making Muslims feel very vulnerable during and following the war. And the switch in French policy toward Israel, as well as some infamous remarks by President Charles de Gaulle about Jews, those things start to make Jews feel more vulnerable as well. And mutual vulnerability coupled with these other factors is an important factor in producing greater tension.
So we can hear, Ethan, what you do throughout the book, which is to closely track how French and international politics impacts relations between Jews and Muslims. But throughout the book, you also keep coming back to the level of cafes and neighborhoods where Jews and Muslims are often living side by side. Why is that so important to your story?
Well, I wanted to tell a story that focused as much as possible on ordinary people. And that gets back to this issue of whether or not Jews and Muslims must understand each other primarily as Jews and Muslims. By looking at the local level, we see that the impact of national and even international conflicts is tremendously variable. And we see that in certain contexts, Jews and Muslims, it's much more important to them that they're neighbors or that they both came from Algeria and they share the same foods and the same music, or that they are both in the position of immigrants who are battling for some of the same rights, or that they are legally different, as was the case for much of this history in terms of Jews having greater rights than Muslims. So there's a whole series of other factors that are often defining daily relations and putting Jews and Muslims in different categories of identification vis-a-vis one another. And for me, a way to trace that was to try to look at spaces like cafes, neighborhoods, music groups, sports associations, where Jews and Muslims were interacting on a more daily basis.
Yeah, and I guess this really brings to the fore this point that you've kept making throughout the program, which is that Jews and Muslims don't have to relate to one another as Jew, as Muslim. They can relate to one another in terms of shared music or food or playing card games together or eating side by side or talking about other kinds of issues. And in fact, in most of our everyday lives, that's how most of us interact. We don't interact in terms of these essential identities, which seem to come to the fore precisely when we feel vulnerable and precisely in context of crisis where we feel attacked. Now, the 1980s and 1990s seemed like periods where coexistence and shared fates were both possible and were thwarted. It seems like a case of one step forward, two steps backwards. To get at this, will you tell us about the group SOS Racisme, how they came into existence and what they fought to achieve, but also why they ultimately failed.
So SOS Racisme really emerges out of two broad political developments. The first is a kind of new multicultural ethos that I argue already starts to emerge in the 1970s, in significant part from the grassroots activism of Jews, Muslims, and other immigrant groups, but also from the Socialist Party coming to power in 1981 and saying very deliberately, we believe there's a right to difference. We're going to start to allow for different kinds of so-called foreign associations, multicultural associations. And this really begins to create a kind of flowering of expressions of public cultural difference. This also produces a backlash from the far right, and that's the second big political development, really beginning with the 1983 and 1984 elections, where the Front National, this nascent far-right party of Jean-Marie Le Pen, which continues to be perhaps an even bigger factor in national politics today, where they begin their rise in significant part by saying there's an immigrant problem, by which they mean there's an Arab or a Muslim problem. In the face of that, Jews and Muslims are really at the heart of a group, SOS Racisme, that emerges to fight racism in 1985. And they say, you know, we're going to put aside the things that separate us. One of their slogans is, we can't solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on the banks of the Seine. But it becomes more difficult over time, particularly at moments like the first Intifada in the Middle East beginning in 1987, or the first Gulf War in 1991, it becomes more and more difficult for those other allegiances to be totally kept out of the picture. And part of the reason for that also is that the far right continues to be very effective at creating a discourse around immigrants as a problem. And so Muslims continue to feel very vulnerable, and even Jews within SOS Racisme become concerned about being associated with Muslims as if Jews are immigrants, whereas Jews have considered themselves included as full citizens in France for a long time. The things that brought the group together are not really enough to sustain this kind of unity and momentum by the late 1980s.
So now that we've discussed the history of the last 100 years, let's close the circle. And let me ask you again, why at this moment, when the bifurcated narrative of Jews versus Muslims and Western civilization versus Islam has taken hold, does a historical perspective matter to understanding Jews and Muslims from North Africa to France?
Well, I think that it matters for several reasons. One is, it's perhaps obvious, but it's so fundamental and it's so often forgotten. We didn't get here inevitably. There were many moments where this history could have gone differently. There were many moments where the history did go differently in terms of a greater multiplicity of relationships. We need to understand that there's nothing essential about the current conflict as being something that must always pit Jews and Muslims against one another, and the Jews and Muslims do not necessarily have to be seen first and foremost as Jews and Muslims, and that even when they are seen as Jews and Muslims, a multicultural ethnic fabric in France doesn't have to mean a fabric where these groups are in conflict with one another. These are fundamental things that we have to have in mind as we're looking at the current situation, because each moment that I talk about in the book was produced by precise historical circumstances, and that is the case for the present as well. In order for us to remember that the future also is not predetermined, we have to realize that the past evolved in ways that were not inevitable.
Ethan Katz, author of The Burdens of Brotherhood, Jews and Muslims from North Africa to France, thanks for being with us today on Counterpoint.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.